Good evening, everybody. I find this slightly daunting experience to forsake the chair for the rostrum and be subject to the same 18-minute rule that I regularly impose on others. But it's doubly daunting because there are quite a number of the members of the select committee who have come to hear their chairman, hopefully, not do too badly, but we'll have to wait and see. Committee was inquiry was conducted against a very loud background noise, principally surrounding the issue of GMOs. My friends, science catastrophically lost the argument on GMOs last year. Earlier, we had faced the fiasco about BSE, where public faith in the regulators was severely damaged. Shell's debacle over Brent Spar was a defeat for what was called the best practicable environmental option at the time, backed by every serious engineer and scientist. Last year's OST survey of biotechnology, the public attitudes to biotechnology, such as reproductive cloning, xenotransplantation, and others, has shown a profound public concern, verging in many cases on hostility. So what has gone wrong? There was an earlier select committee study, which some of us were on, looking into nuclear waste. And one of the principal issues was how do you get public acceptability for a solution to nuclear waste? All the engineers, overwhelmingly, engineers, scientists, geologists, all agreed the deep repository. But the public are totally unconvinced. And we heard on that occasion a lot of interesting evidence from social science. And we were aware that there is a great deal of wisdom out there, many university departments. It's not a very old science in this area, but the science of the relations between the public and science is now quite well developed. And it was against that background that Lord Winston, who he's a glutton for punishment, he's here tonight, asked me if I would chair the inquiry on science and society. So off we went. And we asked, in our call for evidence, what are the sources that shape public attitudes to science? How can dialogue with the public be improved? And there were a lot of subsidiary questions. And should I say very clearly, science, we say in the report, includes engineering, technology, and medicine. So what did our inquiry find? From the outset, we found ourselves faced with a remarkable paradox. Public enthusiasm, indeed fascination with science, is palpable. The sale of popular science books has never been higher. The audiences for serious science programs on the television and radio are huge. And yet, the evidence that we showed quite conclusively that public trust of scientists is actually at an all-time low, and some evidence that it is still falling. The Eurobarometer survey of 2 or 3 months ago showed that quite clearly. And there's a variety of different levels of trust for different kinds of authority. Survey after survey, and we had a great deal of evidence, and it's in the report and in the volume of evidence, show that this lack of trust is profound and widespread, not just in Britain, but on the continent as well. So it has become so serious that we had no difficulty in concluding that society's relationship with science is in a critical phase. Science is advancing so fast on so many fronts that there's a real danger of the public being left behind. The accelerating pace of scientific discovery and application seems to be running well ahead of public awareness, let alone public assent. And the result is not only that people, many ordinary people, feel fearful about what is happening, but this in turn breeds a climate of real anxiety in the science community. Scientists who fear what one broadcaster told us in her evidence is they fear tabloid crucifixion. And there are scientists last year who know exactly what that means. After over a year of inquiry and 400 pages of written and oral evidence, it's quite a big volume, we made 26 specific recommendations. And I'm going to reduce these, it's a numbered conveniently A to Z, but I'm going to reduce these to what I call five main messages. Now, there's quite, it's a very compact report in the sense that it has a great deal in it, and clearly in my time I can't touch anything like all of it. But my five messages. The first message is, yes, there is a crisis. And unless it is faced and addressed, we may find ourselves driving important science overseas and undermining the ability of a nation to earn its living, which in the modern world depends upon increasingly on success in technology. Issues such as cloning, reproductive cloning, stem cell research, which I find scientists still referring to as therapeutic cloning, even though they should know that the word cloning is now a no-no with the public. I even found the Medical Research Council mounting a conference calling it therapeutic cloning, and I blew my top, I have to tell you. But these all arouse serious anxieties, and which may result in the public withholding consent to developments. We had a range of evidence on this lack of trust, but it's no secret that at the bottom of almost every list come government scientists, politicians, and bottom of all, journalists. But nobody comes very well out of it, except possibly the cancer charities. They are trusted, and Lewis Wolpert and I both served on the Council of the Imperial Cancer Research Fund, so Lewis, we're all right. So that's message number one. Message number two. Did I introduce by saying science is not alone in facing public scepticism? All authorities question. Many issues get out of focus. Media hype fouls up much more than science. Yet science has one characteristic in this lack of trust, is that you've got to draw a distinction between public attitudes to the science as such and their attitudes to other values, ethics, morals, environmental concerns, which may well lie behind the anxiety about the science. Many of our witnesses told us that what may appear to be a hostile public reaction to a new scientific discovery may not be hostility to the science itself, but may be due to a belief that it raises these other issues of concern which the scientists appear to be ignoring. They are not listening when those concerns are voiced. And it was in this respect that we were told by witness after witness that what is needed is not so much the more public understanding of science, but many more scientists understanding the public. You may not agree with Prince Charles, as what he says about GMO crops, but his voice has touched off many echoes in society at large. And my friends, we ignore that at our peril. So this is message number two. If you deal with an issue as though it was solely an issue of science, you must not be surprised if the public respond negatively, because they may see this as distorting or even excluding altogether what they regard as other legitimate concerns. So what do we do about it? And this brings me to message number three. For 200 years or more, scientists in the UK have made great efforts to engage the public, from the famous Royal Institution lectures up to the 1985 Bodmer report setting up COPUS, the Committee for the Public Understanding of Science. And here we come, I think, to perhaps the most important central message in our report. Communication is not a one-way process. Scientists, we say, must engage in a dialogue with the public. It was interesting that our call for evidence used the word dialogue. And this has to be much more than simply increasing the public understanding of science. Indeed, that phrase carries the implication that it is a top-down, one-way process. We were reminded in America, a wise American talking to us, say, communication involves ears as well as voices. Scientists must listen. There is a review of COPUS going on, and we welcome that. Bridget Ogilvie is the chairman, and she is conducting this, the Committee of the Public Understanding of Science, and we suggested that it might lead to their considering a change of name. It is seen as condescending, and indeed some quite strong language was used by people whose views we respected. One of my colleagues on the committee, Lord Porter of Lubnham, former president of the Royal Society, was president when COPUS was set up. He suggested that perhaps they might call themselves the Council for Science and Society. Not top-down, not one-way, but implying dialogue, ears as well as voices. And this message is not just for COPUS. This message goes to everybody. The research councils, much good work is done, but much more needs to be done, particularly in helping research scientists to deal with the problems of public communication. The funding councils, we were told that the research assessment exercise counts nothing if a scientist is engaged in popular exposition of his work. If he gives lectures, fine, to a scientific audience. But, I mean, we heard from one witness that some scientists are even being discouraged from writing books, popular books, because it would reduce the RAE score. There are messages for science museums, the science centres, who see themselves as a wonderful vehicle for dialogue, and they need to be encouraged. There are messages for OST and for government, because we believe that some of this work must be financed from the public purse. There must be government support, but we still feel that it ought to be led by the scientific community, by the learned societies, and the other major players. We have useful chapters, which I would not have time, but I think Professor Pidgeon may be talking about this, on the communication of risk and uncertainty. It's a huge subject, but that is one of the issues that we need to make sure that there is a proper dialogue. We had a lot of evidence about science education in schools. We were not looking at scientific careers. We ruled that out from the beginning. Others are doing that. But we did recognize that how science is taught in school has a major influence on people's perceptions and attitudes in later life. And we put forward some, I hope, valuable suggestions as to how this might well be tackled. We had a very interesting day afternoon with the Council for Science and Technology, and that is very much there. Remit. So I end with my last two messages. We must abandon the cult of secrecy, of exclusiveness, in favour of openness and transparency. It's a common message, but our experience in America showed us that where you have a much more open regulatory system, the regulators are much better trusted. And I mean, I look here now at the new Food Standards Agency. And I think Sir John Krebs has started off splendidly. The Environment Agency has tipped its toe in the water to see about public meetings, and others are beginning to think about this. It helps if the public know that they can attend the meeting or get hold of all the information, the reasons for decisions. So openness is important. And then finally, we had a lot of evidence about the media. Many in science blame the media for all their woes. Journalists complain, for their part, that it's difficult to get scientists to respond to questions. And indeed, we were told they can get it more quickly if they ring the United States than trying to ring up universities or research institutes here. We found a very clear contrast between the science editors and science journalists in the newspapers, both the tabloids and the broadsheets, on the one hand, and the news desks and the political correspondents and the news editors on the other. On the whole, the former do their best to get it right. We were quite impressed with what we heard on that. But one just has to remember, they are journalists, they are after stories, They do not see themselves as educators, and that one must never make that mistake. But the really perceived worries about the problems with the press arise when science stories are handled by others, by sub-editors and news desks. So you get the hyped-up headline, which seems to bear no relation to the story underneath it, the sub-editor who doesn't understand the science and wants to spark it up and give it more spin, the editor whose paper goes into campaigning mode and who warns the science editor off, don't confuse us with the facts, this is too good a story. And we've had evidence of that. That's what's worrying. The House of Commons had called for a special new code of practice for science, and we disagreed with that. We didn't think that that was the right answer. In a democratic media culture, scientists, we said, have to learn to take the rough with the smooth, like everybody else. There is no substitute, one witness told us, and we endorse this, there is no substitute for the hurly-burly of public debate. Scientists must get better at handling the media, and the Royal Society has produced some very good guidelines, which we commend. So there are our five main messages. I've lost my slide, so we'll have to do without that. Yes, there is a crisis. Yes, it must be addressed by understanding that it is much more than science, it's other values as well. It must be a two-way dialogue, and there's a huge number of ways of doing that, and everybody is involved. Fourthly, we must make sure that we get better at dealing, well, that's fifth, getting better at dealing with the press. But we also need to look at the problems of transparency and openness. Those are the five main messages of the report. And I believe that they have struck quite a lot of chords since we published. And I shall look forward to hearing them torn apart this evening. Thank you very much.